Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Today's guest is Pennsylvania State Senator Jake Corman. Now serving his fifth term, Corman has represented the 34th District since 1999 and is currently the majority leader in the Pennsylvania Senate. WPSU's Greg Peterson talked with him about the budget process under a new governor, about pension and liquor reform, minimum wage, and much more. Here's their conversation.
Senator Corman, thank you for joining us today.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
With a new governor and administration in place, how do you think the budget process is progressing? Is the June 30th deadline an achievable goal?
We're still hopeful. This is something that is our responsibility to have done by June 30th so that we have authority for government to continue to operate. Obviously, there's a lot of services that are important that go on. People are getting paid, state employees, and school districts need to know the money's coming in as well as universities. So it's important that we're done. And so we're doing everything we possibly can. This is a new governor, so it's hard to tell with a new governor how easy it'll go, quite frankly. After a while, you sort of get a handle on who you're negotiating with and you have an idea how long this might take. This is new for us. So we've progressed in some areas. We have not progressed in others. The deadline's coming quickly. Spending a lot of time in Harrisburg these days trying to make this happen as my new role as majority leader. So I'm hopeful. I'm doing everything I can. That's our job. We'll see.
After a rocky start, how would you now characterize your working relationship with the governor?
Well, I think the personal relationship is good. He's an honorable man that you get an honest opinion from, which is important. So we've had a couple side issues, but none of them really have deals with the budget. But we have significant differences. The governor laid out a budget proposal that raises taxes by $8 billion once it's fully implemented. That's historic. No one's ever begun to ask for that kind of a revenue increase. And we have significant concerns of what that would do to the economy. This isn't Washington, D.C., where we print money. This money comes out of our pockets, out of everyday people's pockets. He suggested that we put a tax on child care. He suggested we put a tax on funeral services. He suggested we put a tax on home health care. Things that have never been taxed before that he's suggesting that we do tax now. So this isn't, sort of taxing somebody else. The Marcellus Shale tax and tobacco taxes, they're sort of popular because they tax someone else. These are taxes everyone's going to pay, across-the-board income tax, across-the-board sales tax increase. I understand he wants to make some new investments. I understand he wants to fund education at a little higher level. That would be great. But at the same time, we can't necessarily take $8 billion out of the economy, send it to Harrisburg, and think that won't have a negative impact on jobs, won't have a negative impact on consumer confidence. So we're working through it with him, and hopefully we'll be able to find some middle ground.
Okay. We'll touch on some of those topics that you talked about. Yeah. I know that pension reform is very high in your own agenda. Could you tell our listeners just what you're proposing?
Well, the governor's talked a lot about the structural deficit since he's been there.
Right.
And the structural deficit is accurate. We do have one. But our revenues are coming in above pace this year, which means actually this fiscal year will end up in a surplus. So the question is, how do you have a surplus and a deficit at the same time? Well, it's because our growth in automatic spending items, such as pensions, such as Medicaid, such as prisons, debt service, things like that, that by law we have to pay, is growing at a faster rate than our revenues. So even though we finished this year probably $300 or $400 million ahead, because of the growth items are about $1.5 billion moving forward next year, that's where you get the structural deficit. So
which is now about $1.2 billion.
Yes.
You think?
So the governor suggested, obviously raise a lot of new revenue that'll cover the spending. Well, that's accurate. The problem is, as I said, I think that'll have a significant negative impact, and you'll see a $29 billion budget head to a $40 billion budget by the end of his term. So our suggestion is let's look at some of these growth items and spending and see if we can curtail them. Obviously, the number one growth item is public pensions. Next year alone, it's $1 billion, $750 million at the state, $250 million at the tax at the school district level. Talk about property tax reform. Every school district in the state is raising taxes, and the reason they're citing is because of their costs towards the public pension system. So, we believe that we need to develop a new system that puts the current system in a better situation, because right now it's teetering. And if we would run into a recession, it could have a significant negative impact where it could be in real trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Put a system in place that has less risk to the taxpayers, and then a more predictable system so that we can afford it moving forward. And so that's what we've put forward. We've put forward a plan that would change it from a defined benefit plan today where the employee gets an automatic number basing on how many years of service and what their final salary was, to a more defined contribution plan, which the private sector has, where you invest, the employer invests with you, and then the healthiness of the fund depends on what your retirement is. And that's the reason why most private enterprise employers have gone to that is because they can't afford the defined benefit plan anymore. States are no different. Retirement plans are nice when, people are, I always tell people that when Social Security was created, the retirement age was 62 because the average life expectancy was 61. To have people retire in their mid-50s and then live into their 80s and 90s on a public paid taxpayer pension, that's a lot to ask of the taxpayers. And so what we're suggesting is develop a more market-based defined contribution system that will be more predictable for the taxpayers and still provide a good retirement for the employees.
Now, I know that courts in other states have struck down provisions like you're proposing. How do you think that will stand here in Pennsylvania?
Well, the provisions that we're talking about are provisions that we have for current employees. Now, the defined contribution we're only talking about for new employees.
Okay.
Current employees, what we've done is tried to go back to pre-Act 9. 2001 is when they gave a benefit enhancement to the employees. They raised their multiplier so they would have a better retirement. The two funds were over 130% funded, and that made sense. There's no sense having that money sit in the fund. It gets into people's pocket, goes out on the economy, and we thought we could afford it. Well, two recessions later, we found it, and this is a lot more expensive than what was initially thought. So now, the funds are in grave condition. And so what we've asked the current employees is we tried to give them new options. Tried to give them, designed a plan that would meet constitutional mandate that would give them new benefit, which they don't have today, meaning if the actual rate, the systems make more than the actual rate, they would benefit from that by lower contribution. Right now they don't. We give them options to say, okay, if you like this benefit, you can keep it, but you have to pay a little more to keep it. If you don't want to do that, you can go back to the pre-Act 9 benefit, which was there before we did the revenue enhancement, and then you would pay less. This is the important part. You would pay less in your contributions. You actually get more in your paycheck every week. So we try to develop options, try to give new benefits so that it's not just like, okay, employees, we need more money. This is a design system to try to allow the employees to see what best fits them. Now, I would just say this. I'm in a system. My wife's in an education system. I always tell people, my neighbor who lives behind me is a state policeman. My neighbor who's in front of me is a correction officer. My two coaches that I coach baseball with, one's a school district employee, one's a Penn State employee. So these are our neighbors. These are our friends.
Right.
This is our community.
And by way of disclosure, I am not. I chose the Tia Kreft route, which is a privately funded type of thing.
Yeah. A lot of my, this isn't like a union issue. This is our community. This is people who we work with and we're friends with. And so we try to design a system that still works. And the one thing I try to tell them that if you have the ability to pay a little more and keep your benefit, the good news about that is when you pay in, you get it all back. When you retire, everything you put in, you get back. If I have to raise taxes a significant amount to fund this system, you're not getting that back. You're not getting your income tax back. You're not getting your sales tax increase back. So in a lot of ways, this actually works better for you. If you have the ability to, we're looking at trying to phase it in so it's not one big shot. And it's about 2.5% of salary, so maybe 3. But so, again, we tried to design it. We tried to meet constitutional mandate so that it would stand up in the courts, and we'll see.
Governor Wolf pledged to restore the education funding that was cut during Governor Corbett's administration, and just about every governor in recent memory has wanted property tax reform, which funds a lot of education. No one's been able to make that happen. Property owners in Pennsylvania shoulder more of the burden for education funding than property owners in most other states. Currently, the state picks up about 30% of the tab for education. In most other states, it's around 50%. How do we flip that? How do we reform property tax.
Well, first of all, let me disagree with the premise to start with a little bit. Governor Corbett didn't cut education. Governor Rendell did. During the recession of 2009, the federal government gave us $2 billion for education and stimulus money. What the Governor Rendell did is he lowered the state contribution to education and plugged in the stimulus money, knowing full well that it was gone in 2 years. So when his term was up and it was gone, you know, Governor Corbett's that federal money left, and Governor Corbett's stuck with a state contribution that's $2 billion less than what the school districts are used to having. And he didn't have the financial ability to raise that back up right away. Now, he's increased it, or he did increase it every year, but just not at the level that we were at one time, because Governor Rendell used federal money to plug a hole. So, but having said that, it's not really relevant at this point. You know, education funding is important. Now, I don't really necessarily get into percentages of how much we're paying, how much the school districts are paying, because, you know, school districts control their budget. You know, they negotiate salaries. You know, they decide how much they're going to spend on technology, on facilities, and things of that nature. So, you know, the state necessarily can't keep up with every school district. Some school districts, particularly in suburban areas, have a larger tax base, and so therefore they like to have more bells and whistles, and that's fine. That's what they should be allowed to do. You know, some of the rural areas don't have that tax base and choose not to do that. One of the things that we are looking at is, and the report's actually due out today, is a fair funding commission, trying to figure out a formula that will drive out education dollars in a fairer way. Right now, you see great discrepancies, basically because of the local tax base in what each school district has. You know, the big example, of course, is Overbrook School District in Philadelphia compared to Lower Marion, which is about 9 miles away in Montgomery County, and you know, the size and scope of the schools are dramatically different. But you can go to rural PA. I mean, go to any of the rural Pennsylvania schools compared to suburban schools, and there's quite a bit of difference because they don't have the tax base locally. And so we're trying to come up with a fair system that makes a little more sense. But, you know, education is important. We try to drive the dollars we have towards it. We still drive a significant amount towards education. And we just have to, you know, try to be smart with the dollars that we have. You know, I'm hesitant to take more responsibility to the state and less to the schools. You know, a lot of people talk about property tax reform and, you know, raising the income and raising the sales and lowering the property taxes. The reason I hesitate on that is, one, I think we need a mechanism to keep the property taxes low then. I mean, if I lower the property taxes, let's say 50% and raise your income and sales, and then the property taxes go right back up, you know, you're hit with a lot higher burden than what you originally were to begin with. So, if we can find some mechanisms to keep the property taxes low, that's important. The other hesitation I have is you lose control. If the state's going to raise more of the money and pay more of the bill, the state's going to call more of the shots. You know, I do believe that there should be local revenue abilities for school districts to raise so that the school districts can develop a educational climate that they feel is important. Again, some have more emphasis on it than others. Some have more emphasis on facilities and technology than others. You know, there's different ways to – in this – I mean, the Commonwealth's a very diverse Commonwealth. I mean, Erie to Philadelphia to Pittsburgh to Scranton and all communities in between are all a little bit different, and they should be allowed to fashion school districts in a way that they deem appropriate. So, you know, if the state's collecting all the money, the states could call the shots, and, you know, that would start to really, really erode local control. And I have concern about that.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Senator Jay Corman, who's the majority leader in the Senate. Thank you for joining us again. And just about every governor in recent memory has wanted to eliminate, change, or alter the way the state deals with liquor sales.
Sure.
Governor Wolf believes it's an undervalued asset and that more revenue could be gained through better practices. And once again, there have been bills to get the state out of the business altogether. Where do you stand on this seemingly never-ending issue?
Well, I mean, a lot of people look at the state store like Governor Wolf does and says, you know, everyone hates monopolies unless it's your monopoly. You know, the state has a monopoly on the liquor system.
Right.
And it makes money. You know, the not only does it have a profit, it raises taxes through the Johnstown flood tax that goes to the state, sales tax that goes to the state, but also they cut us an $80 million check for our general fund budget last year. So it's a profitable system. Of course it is. You have a monopoly. It's going to be profitable. Pennsylvania is one of the largest wholesalers of alcohol in the world. The question for all of us is that appropriate? Is this a business that should be run by the state, or is this a business that should be run by private enterprise? We were joking the other day. Of course, the Pope's coming to Philadelphia, right? Mm-hmm. Told him he can't bring in his own wine. He's got to buy it here at the liquor store.
That would be a sight.
Well, that's the law. And is there a way to develop a system that moves it more to the private hands, to allow private enterprise to run this system that would be more accessibility for consumers, better selection for consumers, and hopefully better price for consumers? There's a difference of opinion whether privatization would achieve that. I do monitor the process because as someone who represents a university town like State College, more access isn't always better for our community. I don't think we want Captain Morgan being sold over the bar at midnight or 1 a.m. In a college town. So there's things like that you have to watch. But I do believe we can move towards a more private hand system. And so we are working on a bill now with our friends in the House. The House have passed full divestiture 2 years in a row, two sessions in a row. And it's a major priority for them. We think it can really create new revenue for the state. We're working with them to try to find a way to allow the private sector to be more involved in this. One little small example is, I represent the borough of Snowshoe. And Snowshoe has a store in there, Pennsylvania liquor store, that's open 3 days a week. And it loses money. We don't make enough sales there to pay the rent. Having said that, the LCB has tried to close it for years, and I've always said no because I said, you're a monopoly. You got to provide services everywhere. So even though you lose money here, these consumers have the right to have access as well. I said, we're looking at models like store within stores where they could take a liquor store, go to a private enterprise store, grocery store, something of that nature, rent some shelf space and put the liquor sales there so that private enterprise, it still would be run by the LCB until we can move it to private hands. But, they would create new traffic for those stores and it would save us money. It would help those stores. And I think those are ways we're trying to move more towards private hands than the traditional liquor store system.
Let's change subject here. The current minimum wage in Pennsylvania is $7.25, which is the federal minimum and was set in 2009. Currently, 29 states and the District of Columbia, including all of our neighboring states except Ohio, New York, New Jersey, Maryland, West Virginia, and Delaware, have minimum wages above the federal standard. Should Pennsylvania's minimum wage be increased?
Well, I was out early on this saying that I think that we can and we should. It depends on how reasonable people are willing to be. If they're looking for a tremendous jump immediately, then we probably can't get it done.
Some states have done it phased over five or six years.
We're looking at a phased, slow approach. The thing I've been interested in seeing is I've had a lot of social service type organizations come to me and lobby me not to do it because they pay their employees at that wage, and they said like childcare. And if they don't pay, if they have to pay a much higher rate, then that makes the cost for the service much higher, and they're going to outprice their customers. So I hadn't seen that the last time we did a minimum wage, but it's been much more prevalent this time around. We're working through it. I think we can and we should. I think we should be probably mirror the federal level. That seems to make the most sense. But if we can get a reasonable phased-in approach, I think.
Well, the federal level is $7.25 right now.
Right,
but we want to mirror higher, don't we?
Right. Well, it remains to be seen. But again, we need to find something that is reasonable, that can be phased in, and an approach that doesn't have a major impact. Let's understand. Over the last 6 years, what Washington D.C. in particular has done has made it easier for people not to work and made it harder for people to employ. A lot of small businesses have new mandates that they haven't had before, Obamacare and things of that nature. So adding this on top of that is another cost. The costs are already dealing with. So I'm trying to be sensitive to small businesses that employ individuals who are incurring new costs. They don't incur a lot more new costs, or else they're not going to hire people. And that's what we don't want. So I think we can do this. I think we should do this. If we just take a reasoned, phased-in approach, we can get it accomplished. If people are going to be pushing too hard, too fast, then we won't get anything done.
Is there any talk of that going on now in the this session?
Well, Senator Baker, Lisa Baker from Luzerne County, is a chair of our Labor and Industry Committee. She's held hearings on it. This is something the governor has put on the table for our budget discussions. And, hopefully, it's like everything else. You got to come to a compromise. And if you come to a compromise, we'll move forward. If we don't, things will stay the same.
More than 472,000 Pennsylvanians have signed up for health care insurance through the federal marketplace in the latest enrollment period, Obamacare. If the Supreme Court rules that subsidies to enrollees in federal-run marketplaces, like in Pennsylvania, are illegal, almost 380,000 Pennsylvanians will be affected. Governor Wolf has applied for federal permission to set up a Pennsylvania-based health insurance exchange as a contingency plan to keep subsidies in place. Do you support that action?
Well, that would have to come through the legislature. And, there's a lot to be determined on that issue. I don't know whether the Supreme Court's going to rule. Once they rule, we'll start to maneuver. I was talking yesterday to Congressman Tim Murphy from in the Pittsburgh area, who's a subcommittee chair of one of these oversight committees. And he said, just be careful. There's things that we're going to have to talk about because there's very expensive cost to setting up your own exchange. When we didn't set up our exchange years ago, it was because we were told not to. That was the general wisdom. Don't set up your own exchange. It's going to be very difficult, very costly. Deal with the federal exchange. Okay, so we didn't, and now they're talking about this may be a problem. So I'm going to wait for what the court rules, try to engross that and see where we have to go and see what our options are at that point in time. So I don't think it's very black and white. Most times you're dealing with the legislation in Washington, D.C., it's not. And so we just have to, A, wait for the court to rule. This whole thing might be moot. They might rule the other way and say that they are legal.
And Congress may jump in and say, okay, we're going to phase it out over so many years and let the states take it over. Or
can you imagine Congress and the president getting together and doing something fairly quickly?
We'll move along from that.
Okay.
It is not happening very
often. There's just a lot there. And so I'm hesitant to take a position solidly one way or another. We're going to try to understand it and then make the best decisions from there.
But you understand it does affect
hundreds
of thousands of people in the state.
No question about it.
Talking about natural gas, Pennsylvania is currently the only major gas-producing state that does not tax natural gas production, opting for a local impact fee. The impact fee has not met expectations. Should a production tax be implemented?
Well, first of all, that is a tax. I mean, it's a tax. I mean, the companies have to pay it. I'm not sure what you call it other than a tax. I know Tom Corbett signed a tax pledge, so he didn't want to call it a tax, call it an impact fee, but it's a tax. If you're the company, you're paying a higher rate than you normally would because of your industry.
Oh, you're paying something. You're not paying as much as you would for a production tax.
Well, it depends on how you write it, obviously. I mean, and I don't know who thinks that it's not living up to expectations. It's been coming in at a fairly significant rate, a couple $100 million a year that's going into our local communities. Look, we're going to have this discussion with the governor. Obviously, it's a priority for him. I continue to maintain that our issue with the natural gas industry isn't that we're not getting enough money from it. The issue is we have all this gas and we don't have markets for it. We're the Saudi Arabia of natural gas in Pennsylvania, and only 50% of our population has access to natural gas. That doesn't seem to make any sense to me. So what we should be focusing on is how do we build the infrastructure in Pennsylvania to be able to get this gas to market? And if you build intrastate lines, lines that just stay within Pennsylvania, then you're not subject to federal pricing. And if you build, I've maintained and have discussed, the Pennsylvania Turnpike is a great right of way. You don't have to worry about my backyard. You don't have to worry about environmental impacts. You could lease the right of way to allow the industry to build the infrastructure. The Pennsylvania Turnpike serves about 75% of our population. If it's an intrastate line, you have accessibility to natural gas to a lot of our population. And then you're also, if you build some industrial parks along the way or business parks, you say to not just Pennsylvanians but to the world, hey, we have cheap power here. That's a big deal. I mean, now you already have the location, being right here near all the population in the Northeast. Now you put cheap power on top of that. That's going to raise more revenue to the Commonwealth by creating more jobs than anything a severance tax would raise to us. Mm-hmm. So, the governor's put this on the table. We're going to have a discussion with him. We're not going to abandon the money that goes to local communities. Those are important dollars that are going to good things in those communities where the industry is operating. So let's understand that these companies already pay business taxes in Pennsylvania, which are high. We already pay all the other revenues that they have to pay in Pennsylvania. They pay an impact fee, which is a tax, which no other company in Pennsylvania pays. I mean, let's understand that. And and when you talk about it, you know, we have a uniformity clause in Pennsylvania. So if we're going to tax an extraction tax for taking natural resources out of the ground, well, why doesn't the coal industry have to pay it? I mean, what is, you know, that's not uniform. I think the companies will probably go right in to sue us. Say you have a uniformity clause. If you're going to tax us for extracting natural gas, you got to tax everyone for extracting natural gas. You know, we never had an extraction tax for oil when we were the big oil area. So there's a lot here. You know, the total tax burden is what makes you competitive with other states. You know, states like Texas have a severance tax, but they don't have the business taxes that we have. So, you know, I'm more interested in the jobs that this can create than the revenue I could take from it. I mean, it's sort of the traditional sort of liberal motto is take from someone you think that has, and then you can put it towards something that you think needs money. And that's fine. We certainly do that on occasion. What I'm looking at here is how can we best benefit the Commonwealth from this industry? And I think getting the gas to market and building the infrastructure so people would have access to cheap power would do far more for Pennsylvania than any sort of extraction tax. Now, again, the governor has it on the table. We're going to discuss it. We may end up with something. I think we need to keep our eye on the big picture here. And the big picture is jobs, because that's what stabilizes communities. That's what moves the Commonwealth forward, is people working. That's what leads to consumer confidence, is with people buying goods. That's what keeps our streets safe. If people are working, crime rates go down. That's what keeps our homes safe. If people are working, domestic violence goes down. Divorce rates go down. And so let's keep our eye on the ball. And what is the best way to benefit from this new technology that allows us to have access to this natural resource? And I think the best way to benefit it is creating jobs.
Yeah, one more question. Sure. It's certainly about taxing in Marcellus Shale. The nonpartisan Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center says that more than 400 corporate subsidies linked to Marcellus Shale gas exploration are registered in Delaware, most within the last several years. And more than two-thirds of the companies in the Marcellus Shale Coalition are registered to a single address in Delaware. It's estimated that the Delaware loophole, as it's called, has cost the state about $400 million annually in taxes. Should we look at closing that loophole? We've only got about a minute here.
Absolutely. We've made some progress on that in the past. Representative Reed, who's now the majority leader in the House, ran a bill a couple years ago that began to do that. The issue is the governor puts on this whole combined reporting issue, which goes further than closing the loophole. I believe in tax fairness. And if you're a company based here in Pennsylvania, you should pay taxes on what you do business here in Pennsylvania. So anything we can do to achieve that fairness, I am for, as long as we don't, again, overreach and then make Pennsylvania anti-business. So it's a trade-off. But I do think we need to move forward to make sure that if you're doing business in Pennsylvania, as we found with Amazon, we found the ability to tax them, which we couldn't before. We closed that loophole so that we have to. We can now. If you're operating in Pennsylvania, you should pay your taxes here in Pennsylvania.
Senator Corman, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
That was WPSU's Greg Peterson talking with State Senator Jake Corman. Corman represents Pennsylvania's 34th district and is the majority leader in the Pennsylvania Senate. To hear more interviews in the Take Note series, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.